welcome to Talk is Jericho. It is the pod of thunder and rock and roll, and we're getting our rock on today with another rock and roll Hall of Famer, the legendary Steve Jones of the Sex Pistols. My second member of the Sex Pistols that have been on. I had Glenn Matlock on about a year ago. Now Steve Jones is here, and he's getting a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame, but not for the Sex Pistols and not for music. He's being inducted in the class of 2018 thanks to his radio career. He's the host of Jonesy's Jukebox on KLOS in Los Angeles, and his long-running show earned him the star. So congrats to Steve for that, and boy, does he deserve it. He is hilarious, man. I'd never met Steve before, but what a firecracker. Funny guy, great guy, what a brother. We're going to talk a little about Jonesy's Jukebox and how it got started and some of his favorite guests, but we're also going to get into his time with the Sex Pistols and about the band he had with Duff McKagan in the mid-90s called the Neurotic Outsiders. Steve's got stories about meeting Kurt Cobain and about being such a huge David Bowie fan as a kid that he actually stole some of Bowie's gear from his final shows in London with the Spiders from Mars. It's a great story. He talks about how much he loves Bowie's guitar player Mick Ronson. Lots of good stuff. And speaking of stories, speaking of good stuff, my fourth book, No is a Four-Letter Word, is filled with them. It's available for pre-order now at my Amazon store, amazon.com/shop/IamJericho. The book is out August 29th, this Tuesday, but you can pre-order it now so that it'll be sent to you as soon as it's released. It's a motivational book. It's a self-help book. It's going to help all of you Talk is Jericho Sexy Beast fans achieve all your dreams by giving you 20 principles describing how I achieved the goals that I wanted to achieve and made my dreams come true. I'm doing a quick book signing tour. It's throughout, let's see, how many states? 1, 2, 3, 4 states. And it's 2 countries, 4 states, and 1 province. So August 29th in New York City at the Barnes & Noble on Warren Street. That's at 5 p.m. Then I got August 30th in Ridgewood, New Jersey at Bookends. That's at 6 p.m. Then August 31st in Tampa, Florida, Barnes & Noble, Northdale Mabry. Then we got Orlando on September 1st, the Barnes & Noble East Colonial Drive. Both of those are at 7 p.m. Then Los Angeles. On September 6th at the Barnes & Noble at the Grove. That's at 7 p.m. Then we head up to Canada on September 18th. Oshawa, Ontario at the Indigo on King Street West. That is also at 7 p.m. And now is the time. I'm going to do this. I did it before when the last book came out, The Best in the World at What? I have no idea. I'm going to read you an excerpt from No is a Four-Letter Word, How I Failed Spelling but Succeeded in Life, with a foreword from Paul Stanley. Had to say that. And this is from a chapter called The Ted Irvin Principle, which is called You Have to Sell Yourself. You always have to sell yourself. And so we're joining this when I'm having a meeting with Vince, trying to figure out what type of a gimmick match I'm going to have with Dean Ambrose at the Extreme Rules pay-per-view. So here we go. This is from No is a Four-Letter Word, and the chapter is called The Ted Irvin Principle, Sell Yourself. When Ambrose and head writer Dave Kapoor and I were trying to figure out what kind of gimmick match we could have as the blow-off to the feud at the Extreme Rules pay-per-view, we didn't really have much. A straitjacket match seemed lame, a paddywhacking match would be boring, and cage matches and ladder matches seemed too played out. We were planning on a self-explanatory Extreme Rules match, but that was given to AJ Styles and Roman Reigns instead, so we were left holding the bag. We put our heads together and came up with the idea of the first ever Asylum match, a cage match with various weaponry hanging off the sides. We loved the idea of involving the variety of plunder that we could use to whack each other at any time. I knew that Vince was a sucker for the first ever tagline, and with that in mind, I began my spiel. When I mentioned that the cage would have multiple weapons involved, Vince mumbled, "I should have known a normal cage match wouldn't be good enough for you two." I ignored his comment and kept right on pitching. I went through the basic rules and the design. Painting the cage black was Ambrose's idea, and then hit him with my closing line that it would be the first ever Asylum match. Vince smiled knowingly and approved it on the spot. We shook hands and I poured myself a coffee because, as Alec Baldwin says, coffee is for closers only, right? We discussed our thoughts on what kind of weapons would be used. I wanted a chainsaw that Dean would cut the top rope in half with and choke me, but Vince declined. Then I brought up the possibility of thumbtacks. Vince laughed and said, "That's not going to happen." I didn't figure he'd go for for it, but I knew Dean wanted to try to get them approved because he had planned to use them in his street fight against Brock Lesnar at WrestleMania 32 a few months earlier. However, Brock wasn't too keen on the concept and the idea was quickly dropped. I, on the other hand, had no issue with using the tax since the plan was for me to beat Dean at the pay-per-view and then challenge Roman Reigns for the title. Therefore, if the tax were allowed, Ambrose was the one who would have to do the hivity-dippity in them, not me. Over the next few weeks, the angle unfolded exactly as we had pitched, leading to some unforgettable moments. The destruction of my jacket was awesome, and instead of just wearing one of my other three light-up jackets to the ring, I switched over to the scarf. We were gearing up for the Monumental Asylum blow-off match when I got a text from Ambrose telling me that Vince had approved the tax. I was totally surprised, but also excited because I knew it would lead to an unforgettable image when Dean took that tack bump. But a funny thing happened on the way to the asylum. Vince changed his mind, what a surprise, and decided to make the returning Seth Rollins the new challenger to Roman Reigns' WWE Championship instead of me. As a result, the change was made for Ambrose to win the asylum match, which made sense since it was his creation, but that meant that if anyone was going to take the tack bump, it had to be me. But why would I, an established veteran with seemingly nothing left to prove, take that diabolical bump? Well, constant reader, pull up a chair under the learning tree, that's the Rhodes trademark, and let me explain to you a little something-something about wrestling psychology. Vince hadn't allowed a thumbtack bump in over a decade, which meant the majority of our fans had never seen such a barbaric spectacle before. And let's be honest, the whole concept of falling onto a bed of sharp objects that pierce your skin and leave you bleeding like a human pincushion is pretty effing barbaric. Like feeding Christians to the lions type stuff. Therefore, the concept of the tack bump had to be protected and sold like it was the absolute worst, most painful thing that could ever happen to a WWE superstar, and I'll tell you why. No matter how much of a wrestling fan you are, you'll never really know how it feels to take a body slam or a suplex. You can guess how much pain you would be in, but you'll never truly know for sure. Therefore, when you see your heroes take this type of punishment on TV, it's never going to resonate with you in a realistic way. However, everybody knows what it feels like to get stuck by a sharp object, whether it's a shot at the doctors or a bee sting, and as we all know, it really hurts. No matter your age, rank, or serial number, everyone's reaction to the prick of the needle is the same. I don't want to get that shot because it's going to hurt when that needle goes into my skin. In the case of the tack bump, if you take the pain of a sole doctor's needle and multiply it by 50, I guarantee there isn't one normal human being on the planet who would willingly allow themselves to be put in that situation. However, wrestlers aren't normal human beings, and I'm not a normal pro wrestler. All that the critics and fans said after the match was Jericho has nothing to prove, and at 45 years old did not need to take that bump. Well, guess what? They were wrong because I did need to take that bump. Because it was what was best for the match. If Ambrose took the bump and then went on to beat me, the whole point, pun intended, of using the tax would have been wasted. It would insinuate to the fans that the tax really didn't hurt and that it was just another stunt show in a show filled with dozens of them. Not on my watch. Much like a musician who plays what fits best for the song rather than showing off, think Phil Rudd and AC/DC, I knew that I would have to take the damn bump in the tax and get pinned directly after, not because I wanted to, but because it made the most sense for the story of the match. I made up my mind I was going to do it, and that was that. Plus, in the grand Jericho tradition of always selling myself, I knew that because the bump hadn't been done in so long, it would be one of the most memorable parts of the show and be talked about for years after. That, in turn, would up my profile, my fan base, and my status. See, selling yourself isn't always as simple as just picking up the phone. Sometimes you gotta get slammed into some thumbtacks to get what you want, yo. The asylum match was kind of plodding, but when Ambrose grabbed a velvet bag out of the bucket hanging from the top of the cage and poured the contents into the middle of the ring, the sold-out crowd in Newark, New Jersey gave a 15,000-person collective gasp, which was exactly what we were hoping for. We teased the bump a few times over the next few minutes, then I tried for a codebreaker. He caught me in midair, turned to his right, and powerbombed me right into the hundreds of shiny silver thumbtacks. When I landed, I thought of Leonardo DiCaprio in Titanic talking about jumping into water that was so cold it hits you like a thousand knives, stabbing you all over your body. You can't breathe. You can't think about anything but the pain. That pretty much nails, or should I say tacks, how I felt. I couldn't breathe with all the pain shooting through my body. It wasn't a deep agony that would be long-lasting, but more of a steady throbbing that felt like a dozen bees stinging me simultaneously. I shuffled and rolled around until I was able to get into my knees, all the while screaming uncontrollably to sell the severity of the bump, and then turned into Ambrose's Dirty Deeds DDT finish. As I took the move, I put my hands up to protect my face, and while I succeeded in not having any of the tacks stick into my mug, three of the little bastards poked through the palm of my hand. Let me tell you, that led to some really serious pain. The crowd popped huge when Dean pinned me for the win, and he left the ring the triumphant hero who proved he was indeed the lunatic fringe he claimed to be. After all, he had barbarically brutalized, what a great thrash metal album title, his hated rival in a way nobody else had in over a decade. Meanwhile, I was left alone in the ring with 68 tacks sticking out of my bleeding body, with the three most painful ones jammed into my hand. That trio of pushpins was giving me so much agony that I decided to make sure the world knew they were there. I looked towards the camera, whimpering pathetically in torment, and held my wounded hand next to my face with the palm towards the lens, giving the world a close-up of my anguish. And why did I go out of my way to get that shot on camera? Because, say it with me now, kids, I was selling myself. Here's the epilogue. After having a total of 68 tacks removed from my back, shoulders, and elbows by the WWE doctors and trainers, every one of them caught on camera, of course, I went to the dressing room to take off my boots. I sat down but recoiled instantly when my ass hit the bench as another flash of torture sliced through my lower body like a Lilliputian spear. I stood up gingerly and pulled down my pants, twisting my neck to try and see my own rear end, which isn't easy, let me tell you, and there it was, the parting gift of the asylum. One last thumb tack sticking out of my left ass. Change that number to 69. The tacks of Jericho. Stick them in, man. All right. Well, I hope you enjoyed the little excerpt there from Noah's a four-letter word, available August 29th. So go pre-order it now at amazon.com/shop/IamJericho and go check out those book signings. All right. Hall of Famer Steve Jones of the Sex Pistols is on his way. But first, let's satisfy your hunger with this amazing pizza deal from one of my favorite pizza places, Little Caesars. Right now, you can get the Little Caesars Extra Most Bestest Pizza for just $6. It's the most cheese and the most pepperoni at the nation's best price. $6 plus tax at participating locations. Little Caesars always has your back. Delicioso pizza that won't break your bank. And the Extra Most Bestest Pizza is hot and ready all day, every day. And Little Caesars' claim of the most cheese and most pepperoni at the nation's best price is based on comparing the following pizzas from the top four national pizza chains. Little Caesars put their Extra Most Bestest Pizza up against the other three chains' large, round, standard menu, one-topping pepperoni pizza, sold at everyday menu prices. And guess what? Little Caesars came up as the best. But you can judge for yourself. Don't listen to my yakking. Go pick up a Little Caesars Extra Most Bestest Pizza at participating location for just $6 plus tax and enjoy the cheesiest, most pepperoni pizza your $6 can buy. Go to Little Caesars now. The Extra Most Bestest Pizza for $6 plus tax is available at participating Little Caesars locations.
Hey everyone, it's former WWE host Lillian Garcia. Let me ask you a question. Do you ever wonder how your favorite stars make it to the big time? Then come check out my new show, Chasing Glory with Lillian Garcia on podcastone.com. Hear me chat with some of your favorite athletes and entertainers about their rise to the top. It's about to get real, raw, and inspiring. So join me for new episodes every Monday on podcastone.com, the new Podcast One app, or subscribe on Apple Podcasts.
This is Talk is Jericho.
All right, so I'm here with Steve Jones, and we just called our mutual friend Duff McKagan. He told us some typically bad jokes, as usual.
Yeah.
You know, it's his vibe.
It's what he does.
And you actually used to play in a band with him at one point.
We had a band in around 96 called the Neurotic Outsiders that was formed basically at the Viper Room in LA. It was put together for a benefit. That's how it first started. Some guy had cancer, and I think Matt had the idea to do a show, help him out a little bit. And the four ended up being the four of us was John Taylor from Duran Duran, Duff, Matt, and me.
So was Duff on guitar as well?
Duff played guitar in that band. Yeah, he didn't play bass.
And sang.
Yeah.
So how was it for you, first of all, to be in a two-guitar band?
I love it. Mm-hmm. I love two guitars because you know you can, when you play a solo, the arse don't fall out of it. You know what I mean? So it's always, don't get me wrong, I love bands that are three piece, like Free, mm-hmm, and Queen. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of bands who are great as a
Van Halen.
Yeah,
who don't need the rhythm guitar element.
Exactly, right. Exactly. So I'm totally into it. But for me, it was a bit of a relief to not have to just keep going jun, all the time. You could like loosen up a little bit.
How was it to play with a guy like John Taylor, who's a very funky type of bass player?
Well, a lot of people couldn't get their head around it because he was from Duran Duran, you know, not the rock world.
Yeah.
But I'll tell you what, man, John Taylor can play the bass with best of them when he's just pumping. He mm-hmm. plays with his fingers too, mm-hmm. so you get that nice big warm sound. I like a warm bass sound as opposed to a clangy.
Hmm.
And he can pump it pretty good. He's good as any other rock bass player.
It is interesting. Like I play bass guitar, not so much now, but especially when I was growing up. And my heroes were Steve Harris from Iron Maiden and Cliff Burton from Metallica, who were finger players.
Yeah.
So I would play with fingers as well.
Yeah.
Not half as good, obviously. But there is a difference between that pick playing and a finger playing.
With the tone, yeah.
With the tone.
Yeah.
That's right, you know?
For sure.
When you were doing the pistols, like you said, which very much is more of like...
Yeah, yeah. As far as bass,
well, yeah, I mean,
because I played the bass on the album.
On the albums, okay.
Yeah.
So did you use a pick or fingers?
I think I used a pick because I'm not a natural bass player, you know. But yeah. I mean, I think I might have done it a couple of times. I can't play it. I'm sure there was a lot of stop or start and punching in. Mm-hmm. Okay, now I've got my energy back. Let's get the next verse.
With the fingers, course. Yeah.
You know, but yeah, original bass player. Glenn Matlock mm-hmm. played with his fingers.
Oh, did he?
Yeah.
Glenn's
yeah.
been on this show, actually.
Has he?
Yeah, about 2 years ago, yeah.
So what, you travel around in whatever city you're in, you kind of...
Basically, yeah. Yeah, like either with wrestling or with music, when I'm touring around, I'll see who's in town. Obviously for LA, which is where we are right now,
yeah.
I'll come out once a month and do a block of shows.
Yeah.
But if I'm in England, I knew a guy that had Glenn on, spoke to him on the phone. I met him at some little coffee house near where he lives,
yeah,
outside of London somewhere.
Yeah, yeah. Maid of Ale?
That's it.
Yeah, that's
it. It was like a little country town.
Yeah.
He showed up with a suit jacket on, and he looked yeah. like a real good-looking, you know, like a gentleman.
Older gentleman. Yeah,
yeah. yeah. But yeah. that's the way I do it. So wherever I'm around, I'll find out who's in town, and
yeah.
if I can get them or somebody that I know, I'll just bring my little pillowcase of stuff and set up.
Oh, cool.
You know? And you know how much fun it is, too, because I know now with Jonesy's Jukebox, which you've been doing for... A dozen years, maybe?
Well, I did it for 5 years when it was on another station, when it was on Indie 103.1. That was from like 2003, I believe, to 2008. And then I didn't do anything for a little while. Then I went to K-Rock for a couple of years, just on a Sunday night.
Mm-hmm.
And that lasted two years. And then that ended. And now I've been doing this at KLOS for about a year and a half now.
Now, what was the concept of Jonesy's Jukebox when you started it? Or what is it now?
The concept was just an accident when I first started it. It was the weirdest thing, man. I wasn't doing anything. I was producing a couple of bands. I produced that band Buck Cherry.
Oh, did you?
Their first album.
Okay.
Played the guitar on it too. But the guitarist don't want anyone to hear that.
To know that.
But he is now. And I was kind of like, you know, it was like, oh, man, the music business was still going a bit at that point. But it was just, and I produced this other band, and I'm like a babysitter. I don't mind producing bands who know what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
But bands like that who never done records, it was like babysitting. I'm like, oh, man, I got to do something else. I don't like doing this. And then I don't know how it happened. I was driving around, and I was flicking the channels in this channel 103.1. Someone said, oh, you should listen to it. They play a lot of punk stuff, and I did. And they didn't have any commercials. It was just punk stuff you never hear on the radio. And it was exciting. I wanted to be involved in it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know why. But then I got a call a couple of weeks later from a guy who was one of the guys at Maverick, who was the radio guy for the New York Outsiders. He said, hey, Jonesy, have you heard this channel? They want to do something with you. I'm like, you're kidding me. I said, I want to be a DJ. And it kind of just happened. I don't know what they want. Maybe they wanted me to just do an ID or something, you know. And they said, okay. So we tried it out 4 days a week, 1 hour a day. And I didn't have a clue, man, a clue what I was doing. It was live.
Yeah.
You know, and I played punk songs. But for some reason, it was refreshing because you know what radio's like. It's kind of a drag, you know, these days. It's just like...
It's very regimented. People play these songs.
Yeah. And the guy with the upbeat voice over the top all the time. So
here we are on Banana 93.3.
Exactly. Yeah. And there's this blithering idiot who's kind of silent, and is like farting and burping. But people start catching on to it. And it just kind of took off. And then it moved to 5 days a week, two hours a day. And, you know, that was a good run. And then, the shit hit the fan in 2008. And, you know, the collapse. And I guess a lot of people weren't paying out sponsorship money. Mm-hmm. Everyone was panicking and holding on to all their money. And the station was kind of a small station, Indie 103.1. Even though it was cool and all the cool people listened to it, so it suffered and the station closed down.
Yeah.
You know, but that's how it started. And now I'm kind of used to it.
Do you still play whatever you want to play?
Yeah, it's very different. I'm not one of them jocks who shout at you. And I kind of talk about random, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I like having interest in people in interview. I interview a lot of people. And it seems to work, you know. People like it. I'm getting a star on Hollywood Boulevard.
All right.
Yeah.
Just you or the whole Pistols?
No, just me.
Congratulations.
Just little old me.
All right. So let's talk.
I know
about
someone
this.
Who's going to be seething.
Your former singer, perchance?
Yeah, maybe.
But that's the thing about this, though. A punk kid from London, 1977, makes one of the most rudest, you know, revolutionary records just based around pissing people off. And now here you are getting a star on Hollywood Boulevard. That's like, you know, Keith Richards becoming a knight.
Yeah.
It hasn't. Mick Jagger becoming a knight.
I think he could have been a knight, Richards. I think he turned it
he
down.
Turned it down.
He turned something down. I know that.
It's a very Keith thing to do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I'm not going to say no to something like that.
It's pretty cool.
You know, I've been in LA 35 years. I've been here. I'm a local, and the fact that I'm getting it on my own back, not from anyone else, from the Pistols or anything else, I can't wait to get that.
Because that's the exact opposite for what you guys do when you got put in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
So tell me the story behind that. What was the decision?
That was mainly John.
Okay.
And rightly so, he was pissed off because they charge. You can come in free,
yeah.
But if you're going to bring anyone else, it's 10 grand.
To sit at the table.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ridiculous.
And, ridiculous. Ridiculous, man. And John just wrote him a nasty letter, and it was so we didn't end up going.
Was it something that you were behind as well, or you just kind of let John do it?
Because
I know Glenn was saying he had no idea. He just heard about it after.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I knew about it, and I was in two minds, but when John did that, I'm like, yes, I think that's the correct thing to do.
It's a very Sex Pistols thing to do.
You're still in there. We're still in there. We just didn't show up for the,
right.
Whatever it is.
For the ceremony.
Yeah.
It's funny because sometimes I wrestled for years and someone's like, oh, when you go on the Rock and Hall of Fame, I'm like, I'm going to pull a Sex Pistols and just not show up. Or pull an Axel and just forbid them to even say my name.
Yeah, forbid. You know? He actually did that, right?
He did.
For the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame?
He didn't show up, and I think Chris Rock maybe or someone read the letter that said, you're not allowed to say my name tonight.
He took it one step further.
One step further.
Than Johnny Rotten.
He beat you guys at your own game.
That was good.
Talk is Jericho.
When you're talking about being a DJ and being able to play whatever you want, like in the 70s, for example, like DJs made a difference.
It's similar to what the 70s, what I'm doing is pretty much similar.
You know, they had the power to even break a band. I know with like Rush, there was a guy in Cleveland who played Working Man incessantly, which finally got them to get some airplay elsewhere. Do you still have, like, if you decide to play something, can you make a difference?
I've definitely, when I was on Indie, I used to play a lot of new bands, and some of them kind of took off, and it put them on the map a little bit. And I'm doing it here with new bands too.
Mm.
I like to do that, and I'm allowed to not just play classic rock, but to play new stuff. It's good. It's good. It's good. I like to play new stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And it's important.
Sure it is.
To me, you know, because it's a, especially rock and roll, it seems like it's a dying thing these days, you know.
Especially on radio.
Yeah.
You know, right now our band has a single in the charts doing really well, but the we're talking about, hey, we just got picked up in Biloxi and we got picked up in Janesville, Wisconsin. There is no Los Angeles rock radio station.
Right.
There's no New York City. It's crazy. It's like, there's no rock station in LA, not for active rock.
Yeah.
You know, you need the, anywhere you can get the help.
Yeah.
Whoever will play.
Yeah, that. Yeah. I know, man. I know.
You know.
So just got to keep plugging away. It's just a sign of the times. It's just where it all is at this point in time, with, you know, young kids. I mean, it's all hip hop and whatever.
Hip hop and country, basically. That's your new rock and roll for the kids.
Yeah, and the country's not good country to me. It's that homogenous. What do you call it? You know, it's just charmed out with the voice tuning, and it's just, it's not country. That's not country to me.
What's country to you?
Old school, George Jones, Waylon Jennings.
Yeah.
You know, where it's like real.
Glenn Campbell just passed away yesterday. Yeah.
Yeah. That was a.
Type of guys.
Just real music, you know. But I'm not meant to like what young kids are doing because I'm 61.
Mm-hmm.
I shouldn't be liking what young kids like. And that, so they're doing their job. You know, I can't wear my jeans around hanging off the back of my ass. I look ridiculous.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, sure.
And every generation has that. Whatever it is, if I moan about it, they're doing the right thing. You know, I don't have to like it, you know. So whatever kids are getting up to these days, whether they're playing it on their computer or whatever, that's their world. And I can't knock it.
You know, that's a great point because you were that guy. If you think about Sex Pistols in 76, 77, you were the band that all the establishment hated.
Yeah.
You know, in such a quick period of time, too.
Yeah, it was real short.
A year and a half, maybe, what it was. Because this year is 40-year anniversary of Bollocks. Do you think about stuff like that?
Not really.
Yeah.
You know, kind of over it, to be honest with you. Don't get me wrong, it was a great thing, and it was a little moment in time where we made a difference, and I don't think a lot of bands get to do that with one album. And it was great at the time.
Are you surprised, though, out of all the bands from that time, that the people just gravitated to the Sex Pistols as being the punk band of that time frame?
Well, in England, we was the first. You know, when we were playing, we one night we at this place called the Nashville. We opened up for a band called the 101ers, which the singer was Joe Strummer.
Okay.
So he saw us, and he's like, I'm done with this. He was doing like rockabilly kind of stuff.
Right.
He's like, I'm done. So from that day on, he decided to cut his hair and wear shirts all ripped up. He got together with Mick Jones, who used to come down and watch us rehearse when he had long hair, and he used to wear platform boots, and he thought he was Johnny Funders from the New York Dolls.
Sure.
After he see us. So they came after us, you know, and, you know, they were a great band. The Damned and who else at the time? It was us, The Damned, The Clash, Buzzcocks, Generation X, Stranglers. They were the ones who kind of was there before the second wind came in. You know, of course you had the Ramones in America, but we really wasn't who we kind of did our thing, you know. And I like the Ramones, don't get me wrong, but we did our thing. And plus it was a different vibe. There was all these stuff going on in the country, like
politically,
strikes. And everyone was pissed off. And so I think that's what made it different than what was going on in the USA at the time.
Well, let me ask you this. So if you're talking about that, a very fast sound, like let's say Metallica was influenced by Motorhead, and Motorhead was influenced by the Sex Pistols. Who influenced you to kind of create that style of music? Was it a glam thing?
It was glam. This was my four or five bands when I was growing up as a kid. It was the... The Faces, Rod Stewart and the Faces, Roxy Music, David Bowie when he was in the Spiders from Mars, Mott the Hoople, glam band, T-Rex. And that was the kind of bands that I thought we were doing when we started the Sex Pistols. If you noticed, the tempos ain't that fast on Sex Pistols stuff. It's not... It's very rock, kind of classic rock beat, you know, not too fast. So that, you know, and then, of course, we got John, who was a different style of singing, and I couldn't play that good at the time. I'd only been playing guitar 3 months before we did our first show.
Unbelievable.
So that's why it got that kind of lack of technical ability, I think,
rawness.
Gave us the sound that we had, for sure.
It's interesting because you think of what you mentioned about the tempos, and people always say that about Motorhead too. Oh, Motorhead, so the Motorhead is not a fast playing. They have faster songs, but mostly it's just rock and roll, man. Yeah. It's Lemmy's obsession with 50s music.
That's it.
With some heavy guitars.
That's it.
But the tempos are not fast.
No,
you know.
Have you interviewed Lemmy?
I love Lemmy, man. It's funny because reading through your book, we were actually both at his 70th birthday party at the Whiskey.
Oh, yeah.
I played that night with Slash and the guys who did a song. But what a great guy. Really, the last few years of his life, I got pretty tight with him.
So did you interview him for your podcast?
I did. And the funny thing was that some people were saying beforehand, well, he's a pretty quiet interview. He doesn't really talk much. I'm like... That's not the guy that I know. And when I walked in, he was on his computer looking at bass guitars. So he was looking at a 67 Rickenbacker, which is Paul McCartney.
Yeah.
So I asked him about that. Talked about basses for 15 minutes. We're off and running. You know, it was a good conversation.
Yeah. No, I love the fact that he likes 50s music.
Yeah.
You know, he's from that school, Eddie Cochran.
Chuck Berry.
Yeah. And I love that too. Mm-hmm. I love that kind of music. I never get bored of it. But he was actually a teenager maybe.
Yeah. And saw the Beatles at the Cavern Club when he was like 12.
Yeah.
So that age.
Yeah. He had a great rock and roll spirit.
Did you get a chance to have him on your show or hang out with him at
times? I had him on the show.
Yeah.
A couple of times. He wouldn't stop smoking in the studio and he had his Jack and Coke. And, you know, he had to keep beeping him every now and again.
Yeah, that's it.
But he was great.
He asked me if I wanted a cigarette, and I was like, I hadn't smoked a cigarette in about 20 years. But when you're at Lemmy's house, and he asks if you want a cigarette, I'll have one. And then he said, he asked me if I wanted a vodka. And I said, I thought you're supposed to stop drinking. He said, well, I stopped drinking whiskey and switched to vodka.
Yeah.
And like Alice Cooper said, like, your liver knows the difference.
Yeah.
You know, right?
Like, no, it's a shame because he could have still been here if he would have... done something about it.
I wonder if you think if you know guys like this, because I remember one time I asked him about that. And he said, you know, if I can't smoke cigarettes and if I can't have a drink, I'm not a health food type guy. You know, I don't think he really wanted to be around if he couldn't live his life the way he wanted it to.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I can understand that, but if I was in this position, I would probably want to stick around a little bit longer too, right?
Yeah. Well, I've been in that, you know, it's in my book I talk about, you know, I've been sober 26 years.
Which
now
pretty crazy back in
I was
the day.
Doing heroin, you know, for 6-7 years, you know, obviously on a daily basis, and stealing to get money to get dope. You know, I was a mess. I was a complete mess, and something happened where I guess I just burnt out, and I'm like, I don't want to keep doing this. See, the difference between me is I didn't have any money. I think Lemmy had a lot of bread, so he could actually just keep going.
Could afford it, yeah.
Yeah, I had no bread. That was the initial introduction I got to a 12-step program. But then I liked being alive. I turned it around, you know, where I wanted to keep going. I didn't want to just drive it into the ground and die, you know. So there was a little spark somewhere in there.
How was that for you? And did you even realize it at the time? We just mentioned earlier about the Sex Pistols was a year and a half, one album, super shot to the top, and then gone right after that. And you mentioned you had no money. Was it hard to like kind of go back to the real world? And what did you do at that point in time?
Well, we never made any money initially. Mm-hmm. The manager made sure of that.
Of course.
You know, so it wasn't a financial thing with me because we never had any bread. I never had a driving license. I never had a bank account, a checkbook, nothing. I didn't have anything. And then it all ended. Then me and Cookie decided to form a band called The Professionals. But that when the band ended, that's when I started getting into into dope.
Because mm-hmm. you were just a kid too, right? 22 yeah. years old?
Yeah, when we started, yeah. Right. Yeah, slung in the deep end.
Mm-hmm.
The Bill Grundy, when we swore on TV, mm-hmm. so prior to the Bill Grundy show, we were getting popular in the rock world, but the day we did this talk show, the Bill Grundy show that was everyone watches in England, that then it went into this other world of media and tabloid, and the music just got pushed to one side.
Well, tell us for people who don't know what happened on the Bill Grundy show.
The Bill Grundy show was this guy. It was called the Today Show, and it was hosted by this guy Bill Grundy, and it was just at 6 o'clock where everyone's at home eating their, you know, sausages, and this guy has various guests on, you know. And Queen was meant to be doing it, and we just got signed to EMI, so we were on the same label. And they said, "Well, get the Sex Pistols on. They're going to be doing this tour, Anarchy in the UK tour with us, the Clash, the Damned, Johnny Thunders, and the Heartbreakers."
It's a hell of a bill.
Yeah,
yeah,
great. So we were rehearsing somewhere, and a limo comes and said, "Come on, you're going down on the Today Show now." And so we all piled into the limo, got down there. They stick us in the green room. I immediately went to the fridge and drank a couple of bottles of Blue Nun because I was nervous, you know.
That's wine, for a couple of bottles of wine, basically.
Right? Yeah, yeah, yeah. And so I was ready, you know. And we went out there, and this guy obviously didn't give two hoots about us, and he just tried to kind of belittle us, you know. He just thought we were like these young punks. It was that classic thing I'm talking about, where the old man just thinks this is crap.
Didn't understand it.
And Susie from Susie and the Banshees was a fan. This is before she had her band. We brought a couple of fans on with us who sat behind us. It's all on YouTube. You can watch it. Bill Grundy Show, Sex Pistols. It's worth...
amazing, yeah.
I mean, it's nothing compared to things now, but at the time, when there was only two channels to watch, it was a big deal. No one ever swore on TV. So he said something sarcastic to Susie, like something sexual. "Oh, we'll meet after the show, didn't you?" Mm. So I just fire into him, and I call him a bunch of swear words, you know, and it went out live for some reason. and the next day, it was like another, it was all different.
Mm.
We were household names. We were the bad guys of rock and roll. And wherever we went, the daily papers were just following us till we broke up, you know. And it was great for publicity, but I think it was the beginning of the end because it was too much for us too soon.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't write. We wrote a couple of bullshit songs after that. We didn't, you know, we got rid of Glenn Matlock, who was in on the Bill Grundy show, and we got Sid in. And it was just meant to be. It was just one of them things.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think you could avoid it. I left. We did a little tour. We ended in San Francisco, and I just said, "I'm done.
Mm-hmm.
I'm out of here. I can't. It's too much."
Well, like you said, too, the music got pushed aside about the Bad Boys. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's similar to why the Beatles stopped touring, where it was more about the spectacle and the chicks screaming, and no one's paying any attention to the band whatsoever.
Yeah, and it's no fun. It's like, why are you doing this?
This is Talk is Jericho.
When did you start realizing the influence that the Sex Pistols had on other musicians?
I'm sure at the time it was going on, but I was too out there to comprehend what was going on and who we influenced. I noticed later when I came to LA around 73, I moved to LA. I drifted out here.
Before the Pistols or after?
After the Pistols.
83. You said 73.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, okay. Yeah, you're right.
You lost a decade.
Sorry.
That's all right.
I sure did lose a decade.
More than that.
You're right. And I grew my hair long, and I sobered up, and I started playing. And I'd run into Axl outside the Rainbow.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be there on my Harley. I was all buff at the time.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I had long hair. You didn't have to wear a helmet.
Did people even know who you were?
Well, I was on MTV a little bit.
Oh.
But not crazy. Not crazy, no.
Like hosting on MTV, or did you have another song?
No, I did a bit of that Headbanger Ball.
Okay, gotcha.
I did a few of them. Not a lot. I mean, a lot. I had a solo album out. But, man, it was like shooting ducks in a bucket. I wouldn't even go in the Rainbow. I just have a chick on the back of the bike four times a night, just getting sucked off.
Rock and roll, man.
Man, I made up for lost time. When I was doing dope and you don't do any pussy,
yeah,
I made up for lost time.
See, being sober has its advantages.
Yeah, well, it did for me.
So you ran into Axel in front of the rainbow?
Yeah, he was, this was before he was, you know, they were just, they were going. They hadn't quite broken yet. People knew who he was, but he showed up and he had a big long leather coat on and looked like, you know, could have been in a Nazi party. I mean, he came up to me, man, and he was like, oh, man, I love your band and blah, 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 blah. I mean, he really paid homage to me.
Mm-hmm.
And Duff is a punk fan.
He is.
Too.
He's a punk guy.
He's a punk guy. He is. They're not all punk guys in Guns N' Roses. He's the most.
But once again, another reason why Guns N' Roses had a little bit of that vibe, because Duff was in the mix as a punk rocker.
Yeah,
yeah,
absolutely. And Axl actually on my second solo album, he sings a Sex Pistols song on it.
Okay.
Him and Ian Ashbury, a song called "Did You Know Wrong."
Mm-hmm.
And I ran into other bands, Nikki Sixx. They did a version of a Pistols song.
Megadeth.
Yeah. Even
Anthrax,
yeah.
God Save the Queen, I think.
Yeah. So there was definitely, and Megadeth.
Yeah, Megadeth did. I think Megadeth did Bodies too. They had a couple of them.
That's right.
They did Bodies and Anarchy.
That's right.
Yeah.
So then I noticed that, okay, well, I guess there's some influence there, which is weird from these kind of rock metal guys, mm-hmm. you know. But I appreciated it. So I guess we made some impact. There was a period, though, after we broke up, when it turned into, like, new romantic music in England. You got your Duran Duran, mm-hmm. Spandau Ballet, all them other bands. At that period, we couldn't get arrested.
Hmm.
No one gave two shits about us.
Early 80s?
Yeah.
85, 86, yeah.
There was a period where it was just out of fashion, mm-hmm. and no one wanted to know.
Mm-hmm.
But then it kind of came back. Around that time, when I moved out here, 84, 5, 6, and it seems like it's just here now.
Was there a lot of influence in grunge bands like Nirvana, etc.? Were they punk, Sex Pistols kind of influence as
he
well?
He was.
Yeah.
He was, and he blatantly said his two favorite bands was the Beatles and the Sex Pistols, mm-hmm. you know. And I met him once, and he was another one who was in awe. I went and saw him in the hospital. He was in there for some stomach problem.
Oh.
And someone said, go and see this kid. He's got this band. He's in there. It was the doctor who was helping him who knew me.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why he said, go and see this kid. And I did. And thing, he was sitting on a chair and he was in bed with a beard. And I didn't really know. I swear to God, I didn't really know who he was, other than he was like picking my brain and he was all excited.
Hmm.
And then when I left and I realized, oh, that's the guy from the Teen Spirit
thing,
you know. Yeah. I really didn't know. It was weird. So, yeah, he was into it. Who's the other guy who's dead too?
From that?
Alice.
Oh, Lane Staley.
Lane. Mm-hmm. He was a sweet guy. We used to talk a hell of a lot too.
But that's the thing, like you said, that you don't realize it at the time, this monumental music that you're making or whatever reason it sticks. But now with Jonesy's Jukebox and you're interviewing so many guys, who are some of your favorite guests that you've had on the show, reoccurring, etc.?
Man, I mean, I have so many guests as you do. Lars.
Oh, yeah.
Was an interesting one.
Mm-hmm.
It was funny because he came on. I mean, I've met him before many times. But he came on. They were doing their, you know, they were promoing. They were
doing a press tour, yeah.
Yeah. And he came on. And I always, like, ask the stupidest questions. And we started talking about tea. And then we started talking about Earl Grey tea,
yeah.
which he likes. And we must have spent 20 minutes talking about Earl Grey tea.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then he realizes, hang on, I'm in Metallica. I can't be talking about Earl Grey tea. It was the funniest thing. And he knows his glam too. He loves glam.
He's a musicologist.
Yeah.
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 He really does.
So that was a good one. Man, I've had so many Foo Fighters.
Oh, Grohl's a big punk guy too.
Yeah.
Fan of music.
He actually, when my book came out, they all came on the show,
mm-hmm.
the whole band. That was great. And then he filled in for me when I couldn't make it one day, him and Taylor.
Oh, cool.
And he did my accent for the whole 2 hours. You can listen to all this. It's all on, podcasts, on the KLOS website. Can't play the music. Do you play music?
Yeah.
Do you have to pay? Do you have to pay someone for that?
Oh, I'm sorry. No, you can't. The only music I ever play is just ours because I don't have to pay. Yeah. But you can't.
Yeah.
You can't. There's too many rights fees and all that.
Too much dough. Yeah.
And people always go like, hey, like Sebastian Bach. I've had him on my show 3 or 4 times. He was like, well, why can't you play any of my songs, dude? I'm like, same reason I couldn't play him last time, Baz. There's too many pirate, royalties and red tape and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah. It's a drag, really.
It is. Let me ask you a question. When you were talking earlier about your favorite bands, you mentioned Bowie and the Spiders from Mars. Mick Ronson, one of the most underrated guitar players of all time.
Oh man, he's my main man.
Yeah,
Mick Ronson is my main man. I've said it for years. I'm not saying it because it's cool to say that. But
and I didn't ask you because I had heard. You mentioned Spiders, and I wanted.
No, he was. I loved his guitar playing. Not too much, but tasty. I love his rhythm playing because he had a wah-wah that he would set at a certain spot. He'd leave it open a little bit, and that's where he'd play his rhythm on.
Interesting.
And he was a genius too, man. He was classically trained. A lot of people don't know that about him, like on Lou Reed's album Transformer.
Yeah,
I mean, he arranged a lot of them songs. He didn't get any credit. He arranged a lot of the two Bowie albums too.
Yeah,
Spiders from Mars and Aladdin Sane. He did all the arrangements for that,
but didn't get the credit.
No credit. I mean, I don't know if he wanted it or what. He tried a solo career, but he was the perfect side man. The guitarist to someone who's a great front man.
It's interesting. I see that from time to time. I don't know how much of a metal guy you are, but I know you know the names. When David Lee Roth first went solo with Steve Vai on guitar, and then album or two later dumps him and brings somebody else in, the magic's gone.
Yeah,
Ronnie James Dio with Vivian Campbell dumps him. Bowie Bowie still continued, but he didn't have the same magic as he did with Mick Ronson.
No.
And why would you just not take that partnership and run with it?
I don't know.
I don't know why
bands do that, but I mean, I get the fact that, like my band, when it's over, you just walk and rhyme or reason tells you don't do that yet, because you do good stuff when you're together, but it don't matter.
It gives me more respect for guys like Mick and Keith that never
to go that long. Yeah,
and they might have taken time away, but they never broke up. Aerosmith, even Joe Perry leaves for a while, but Mick and Keith never did that. It's interesting. They come
to an arrangement,
Exactly.
Plus, they made shitloads of money.
Wow, that's
so
a difference
would keep
too.
You together.
Sure, it does. Have you ever had any of those two guys on your show, or any relationship with the Stones?
Stones, no. I would love to, though.
Yeah, I mean, they would have to know the legend of you and the Sex Pistols for sure.
Well, there was a period where Mick was wearing some punk clothes. Yeah. He was wearing the T-shirt with a swastika on it that was. So he was very hip, Keith. He kept...
Sure, yeah. In 77, 78, too. That was, in the middle.
Yeah.
There's a great story in your book where you talk about, just to finish up on the Bowie topic, where you were nicking a lot of different things, and you actually nicked some of Bowie's stage gear.
Yeah. Their last show, went before he announced that The Spiders from Mars is over.
He announced that on stage, right?
Yeah, he did two nights at Hammersmith Odeon, which is now called Hammersmith Apollo. And they'd been on the road for a while, and the band didn't know that he was going to say this. But after the first night, they left all the equipment up because they knew they were going to play the next night. And I knew that place, the Hammersmith Odeon, like the back of my hand. I was like the phantom of the Hammersmith Odeon. And I was a kleptomaniac too. So I got a little minivan, parked it round the side when everyone had left, like at one in the morning. They put some goon on the third row, and he fell asleep. And I just snuck on the stage and started snipping microphones and took the bass head and the cymbals and Bowie's mic with lipstick on it. I didn't touch any of Mick stuff.
You didn't take any Ronson stuff?
No. But what was funny was, on my radio show last year, Woody Woodmansey, the drummer, he was doing a little tour with Tony Visconti.
Okay.
Where they were going city to city. They were doing that one Bowie album that Visconti played on. And Woody Woodmansey, it was an early one. It was.
Wasn't Visconti also his producer towards the end too?
Yeah, well, he produced all the Bowie's.
Yeah, okay, gotcha.
That stuff. Yeah, yeah. And T-Rex. He was a big producer back then. Anyway, so they were playing a place called the Wilton here, and I got them on the show. So we're talking away with Woody. I said, and on the air, I'm like, shall I say this on the air or off the air? I said, oh, fuck it. I'm just going to say it and see where the cards lay. I said, Woody, I owe you amends. I stole some of your cymbals from the last at the Hammersmith Odeon. He goes, you did? I didn't know. I said, let me, what can I do to make it right? He said, oh, it's okay. I said, let me give you some money. He said, oh, give me $100. And I gave him $300. And he was over the moon. Over the moon. Man, and that guy, is he a powerhouse still?
Yeah, still.
Unbelievable still. Drummer. Unbelievable.
Does he still have the giant sideburns?
No. He's tiny. Tiny, yeah. Too. He's doing, you know, he's doing construction in England.
Really?
Poor guy.
You know, it's interesting you talk about tiny because Ronson was tiny too, and you could so see the influence on Randy Rhoads of Mick Ronson.
Yeah.
Hair, same stature, yeah. Same long guitar because that's they're cool. So small. But you look at Mick, that's Randy Rhoads.
Yeah.
He looked exactly like him.
Yeah.
Which is another reason why I'm so surprised that he didn't get more credit after being Randy Rhoads being such a disciple of Ronson.
Yeah, I just think Mick didn't put himself out there enough. Mm-hmm. You know, he was just a quiet dude who just wanted to get on with it. There's a great documentary that just came out in England about him. I'm sure it'll be out here soon. Where it's very gives him for what he did have.
Yeah.
You know, which was good. Unfortunately, I actually went on the road with him.
Really.
On my second solo album, he was playing with Ian Hunter.
Mm.
It was Hunter Ronson.
Mm-hmm.
And I did a bunch of shows opening up for him. And I would get on their tour bus sometime and just hang out.
That's
with,
cool.
With
it's always cool when you get to meet your heroes and become friends.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, he was a sweetheart.
Let me ask you about this. Another thing reading in your book that I had no idea with is that you actually played with Dylan.
Yeah.
And played live with him in a band?
Played live.
Okay.
I got a phone call from him. He's like, hey, Steve. That's Bob Dylan.
That's good.
He said, he said, I'm doing this record. Can you put a band together and come down to this? So I got Paul Simonon was in town from The Clash, the bass player. I got him. I got Gary Myrick. Guitar player. Who was the drummer in Pat Benatar band? Redhead guy.
Myron,
yeah.
Myron something or other. Yeah.
Exactly.
Got good it. Call on that. Good memory.
yeah. Well done. He was around and it was and me. And we went down to Cherokee Recording Studios.
But why is he calling you?
I have no idea.
Just, okay.
No idea.
Dylan, whatever.
But he does that. He just, you know, he gets, he's something he likes and he, I mean, we had the motorcycles. He was, you know, he was up riding bikes at the time. I don't remember how that goes, but whenever I would see him in a party, he'd come running over and give me a big hug. And I'm like, okay, chill, man. I'm just trying to chill. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
He was fantastic.
Was he a Sex Pistols fan?
I don't know. Maybe he liked the attitude of the Sex Pistols.
Yeah, the rebelliousness of it.
I don't know. But so we're all there. We're set up in this studio. He shows up with his acoustic and a bunch of papers. He puts them on the piano, and he started going through the papers and goes, okay. And he would just start playing a tune, you know, just rough tune. And we're kind of just all looking around. I'm like, okay. And we kind of just joined in, you know. I've never recorded like this. It was the weirdest thing. And I didn't quite understand what was going on at the time, that he was seeing what we'd come up with.
Oh.
And all we were doing was the minimal, just following him. So a lot of it didn't take.
Mm.
But I guess that one song did take that's on this album, Sally Sue Brown. You know.
That's the name of the song, Sally Sue
Brown. Yeah. I can't remember what album it's on. But it was, looking back on it, it was a buzz to experience to do that and actually end up playing on one of his records.
Interesting comment. Like you said, he was waiting for you guys to see what you
could do. I didn't see that at the time.
It's a great story that I heard with Bruce Springsteen when after Clarence Clemons died.
Yeah.
He brought in his nephew. I think his name is Jake Clemons, maybe, to play saxophone. And at one point, they said, you know, Bruce wants you to do a solo. And the kid was kind of really scared and didn't do anything. And afterwards, it's like, why didn't you do a solo? He goes, I didn't know what to do. He said, listen, when the boss tells you to solo, you solo. And if not, you don't get no more solos.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, show us what you can do, kid.
Yeah.
Get out there and play.
Are you a fan of Springsteen?
Not diehard, but I went and saw him live a couple of years ago and I got it. Like, I understood the brilliance of Springsteen.
How long did he play for? 10 hours?
Yeah, 72 hours. He played for 3 hours, and I knew three songs out of the 30 that he played.
He's got some diehard fans, though.
He does. You know, he would just take signs out of the crowd, show them to the drummer, and they'd go into it.
Yeah.
You know, and it was just watching him do that with a 17, 18-piece band. It was one of the best gigs I've ever seen, for sure.
He definitely puts on a show every night. There's no dialing it in. He really gives it everything.
And doesn't stick to a set list. Just plays whatever he feels like playing. You know what I mean? A few last things. Were you ever I can probably know the answer to this. Were you ever a Beatles guy at all growing up?
I always said no because I thought it was cool to say you didn't like the Beatles.
Yeah, of course. But now?
And it was the Stones. I never played the Beatles. On my show, I always played at Stones. Mm. Always play old Stones, 70s Stones. That's always, I always fall back on that.
Mick Taylor Stones?
Yeah.
Best era.
Goat's Head Soup.
Best era.
Fantastic album. Yeah, he's a real lead player.
Yeah.
I read an interview somewhere with Keith, and how he was kind of basically saying, you know, when Mick Taylor plays, he's like, I hate that guy.
Yeah.
Because I can't play lead like him, right. You know.
If he's not in your band, you hate him.
Yeah. But the Beatles, I mean, yeah, they got obviously great songs, but I'm never drawn to playing them.
You know? Gotcha. I just didn't know if you ever had any meetings with Ringo or Paul.
Oh, I know Ringo.
Do you? Yeah.
Pretty good, yeah.
But did he appreciate the...
He ain't going to hear this, is he?
If he does, I'll be tracking him down.
Paul McCartney, I spoke on the phone once on my old radio station.
Okay, so that's still pretty cool.
Yeah.
Got him on. So these guys are calling you, they're obviously knowing the Sex Pistols, maybe not know the exact minutia, but still know the legend of the Sex Pistols.
Yeah, yeah. The legend of Xanadu.
My friend Adrian Smith plays in Iron Maiden. And he met Paul once, and Paul's like, oh, yeah, I'm in Iron Maiden. And Paul's like, oh, that's the band with the monster.
That's classic.
Yeah, at least he knew that. Actually, there's something else that we have in common I want to bring up. So about 98, we have a show in Tupelo, Mississippi. I have too many cocktails. I have to take a leak, and I go into the bushes right by Elvis's mom's house, which is a monument, and no disrespect to Elvis's mom or her house. Reading your book, you have something in common with me on that as well, don't you?
Is it to do with urine?
And Elvis.
Yeah. So you did that too.
And at Elvis, the house that he grew up in Tupelo.
Right. Is that still like a tourist attraction?
It's like, you know, this is Elvis's childhood home. Yeah. Go look around.
Yeah, where did you relieve
bushes,
yourself?
In the bushes, right beside the house, on the side of the house.
Yeah.
So, it didn't get as much hassle as Ozzy at the Alamo, but then I'm reading your book, and you had an experience as well.
Yeah, but you know what? I'm going by one of the guys in the band from The Professionals told me this. I don't actually remember
okay.
doing it.
Well, you should be cleared of all crimes.
Yeah. Don't get me wrong, man. I'm a huge Elvis fan, you know. So I don't know. That one's kind of up in the air.
You may or may not have peed
whether I pissed on his grave or not, yeah.
See, but that's not disrespect. That's just more of a rock and roll thing, I think, maybe more than anything.
Yeah, would he mind, you think, Elvis, if I did? Have a lag on there.
If it didn't actually go on him, I think he would appreciate the concept of it. you know, I mean, he wasn't allowed to show his hips on TV. So
exactly.
This is just the next version of that.
So he should have pity on me. For
exactly.
That.
Last thing, we got some good stuff here at the end of your book, things that are not rock and roll. And I never write anything down when I do a conversation, but I had to at least bring this to reference. So things that are not rock and roll, according to Steve Jones, baldness.
Yeah.
Definitely agree on that. That's why you can still go see the Stones and McCartney and they look great because they still have their hair.
Yeah.
You got great hair.
Yeah.
So that works. Did you see somebody that was bald that made you put that on there?
Scorpions.
Good call. They were bald in 1984.
Yeah, the singer, right? Oh, well, actually, a few of them.
Oh, yeah. That's what I always say to Biff from Saxon. Like, dude, you guys would have been so much bigger if you guys actually had more hair.
Yeah.
Biff has hair, and that was about it.
Yeah.
You know? Double chins, definitely not rock and roll. If you want to see that on stage, once again, mixed, super thin.
Yeah.
Still hot. Looks good.
Yeah.
What's perspex around the drum kit? Perspex.
You know, like they put them things so you can't hear them.
Oh, like the
a perspex shield.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Like the kind of the plexiglass.
Yeah, because they're using the bloody
the inner ears.
Inner ears, so it blocks off, trying to block off any sound coming off the stage. And to me, if I can't hear the bloody amp and I can't hear the drums behind me,
yeah,
there's something wrong.
You're right. And here's another thing you have in there, because I use inner ears, inner ear monitors. I don't have hair plugs, but inner ear monitors, which are like ear plugs that are connected to a pack,
yeah,
where you can hear the entire mix on stage.
Yeah.
Obviously, you never had that.
I'm sure it's good for your ears.
Yes.
And you won't get a tinnitus.
Yes.
And every nitus.
Yeah.
But for me, I mean, I don't know if I'll ever get to that point. The older you get, you never know. I might come submit to it. You know, but when we toured in 2008, I never used
with them. The Pistols reunion.
Yeah, I like the Marshall. I like the Fielder oomph behind me.
And I don't like wearing them in both sides because I hate the sterile sound with no crowd noise.
Yeah.
So I'll put one in and one out.
Yeah.
So at least I can hear the reactions.
Yeah.
But it also means that my left ear is great, my right ear is shit.
Yeah.
Because I can't hear.
Do you get buzzing in it?
Not yet, but after some, you know, 5-6 shows,
yeah,
in a row, you'll
no, get it. No, I get it.
I understand the reason for it. Do you still play live?
Here and there.
Yeah.
Get up and jam with someone here and there. Not a lot.
That's about it, right? Publicists?
Yeah, the
not
worst.
You never had a publicist?
I've had publicists. Everyone, but to me, like, they're the worst people in the world.
Worse than lawyers?
Oh, man.
Or managers?
Well, you know, publicists just get on my nerves. They come in, they think they own the place.
Yeah.
You know, and they kind of always on the bloody phone. They just bug me.
Click tracks.
Yeah.
Very any punk.
Well, I think, un-punk. You know, any good records back in the 70s, I don't think were ever.
You know, it's interesting. I'm sure you noticed this. I know you noticed this about how much more human records were in the 70s. You can hear mistakes. You know, there's a couple of those AC/DC records. The guitar is completely out of tune,
yeah,
on Power Age for sure. You know, you don't get that anymore.
Yeah. I don't think... I mean, I like to hear things in tune, don't get me wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But click tracks, oh, man, they just kind of limit you. You can't... I don't know. I think they ruin the feel. I'm sure there's a million bands who have made great records that I love have been on a click track. I just thought it was funny.
It's great. This is a great thing. And then the last one, well, there's good. Cunts hang out on both sides of the stage. Cunts who say they saw you 40 years ago but secretly hated you back then.
Yeah.
Cunts who get your signature and then sell it on eBay.
Yeah.
Very much a pet peeve of mine as well.
The eBay thing?
Yeah. Well, you'll see these guys show up at the airport.
I know. You see them a mile away.
Oh, yeah.
You know what ones they are.
And there'll be like a whole mob, and then you'll say, okay, I'll do two for each. That's fair.
Yeah.
If I went and saw McCartney, he signed two things for me. This guy gets his two.
Gets all the albums out.
Goes to the back of the line, comes back up again.
Yeah.
I said, I just saw you. He said, no, you didn't.
Yeah.
You were just here. No, you didn't.
Some of them have tricks, man. They'll get a little kid to bring up the album. That's how far they go.
Yes. To judge, to take pity on the,
yeah,
on the youngster, you know?
Get your heartstrings.
Yeah, exactly, right? Then the last one, Paul Schaefer.
Oh, no. Things that are not rock and roll. He's actually, you know what? He was great in Spinal Tap.
Yes.
Kick me in the ass, guy.
Kick this ass for a man. Artie Fufkin.
Yeah. And I'm sure he's a sweet guy, but whenever I see him jumping around on Saturday Night Live with his bald head, It's just...
That's two things. He's bald and he's Paul Schaefer.
And he's not rock and roll. I just... It just bugs me. I'm sure he's a good guy. He's played on a lot of big records too, but...
He's always on stage when they do the Rock and Roll Hall of Fames or anything like that.
That's another reason, yeah.
Oh, that's right. Rock and Roll Hall of Fame also in your list over there. What's your favorite band of all time?
Oh, man.
Is one that sticks out?
Well, it's one of them... Faces, Roxy Music, David Bowie. It's one of them three.
Yeah.
Cut it down to three.
Depending what day it is.
Yeah.
How about a Pistols song?
Bodies I Like, No Feelings, Holidays in the Sun, Liar, 17... They're my favorite.
A lot of good ones there, yeah.
You know, the ones I wrote.
Steve, it's been a blast, man.
Yeah, mate. Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much, my friend.
What a great hang with Steve Jones, and you should check out this radio show, Jonesy's Jukebox, on 95.5 KLOS. If you're ever in Los Angeles, he tells the stories, has some great music guests, and of course plays a lot of cool tunes, and he's super funny. He's funny AF, as you heard. Thanks again to Steve Jones. Check him out on iHeartRadio. I'm sure it's up on there as well. And thanks to all of you for being here and listening and laughing, and thanks to all of you for checking out this show and leaving it ratings and reviews and doing the same for all the great shows on the Jericho Network, Killing the Town, Rock Talk, Raven Effect, Keeping It 100, Beyond the Darkness. Get that paranormal fix every Wednesday, every weekday, Monday through Friday, with brand new episodes. Lots of great stuff, man. Lots of other shows coming too. I got a couple good ones on the wire that you're going to enjoy. And trust me when I tell you, there's some good stuff coming up, both on the Jericho Network and right here on Talk is Jericho. Because next Friday, well, I'll tell you in a second, it's going to be your next Friday. But I want to thank you for being here, and thank you for supporting all the great sponsors of this show, Bombfell. Get $25 off your first vouchers at bombfell.com/Jericho. MyBookie. Join now at mybookie.ag. MyBookie.ag, and use the promo code Jericho to have MyBookie match your deposit up to 100%. Then there's Little Caesars. Get the extra most bestest pizza for just $6 plus tax at participating location. Of course, TrueCar, cheaper, quicker, easier car buying experience. Thank you for listening. Keep listening for the 60-second AP News headlines coming up next and coming up on Friday. Who's got the best guests for you? I'm talking about the brand new NXT champion, Drew McIntyre. He is returning to Talk is Jericho 3 years after he was fired. I had him on the show 2 days or 3 days after he was let go by the WWE, and now he's back 2 or 3 days after he's the new NXT world champion. Goes to show that you can do anything you put your mind to. We'll see you on Friday. Thank you so much. In the meantime and in between time, stay hard, stay hungry. Peace, love, and hugs, and a big yeah, boy. God save the Queen. We mean it, man.